I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. Recent warnings from the World Health Organization about the global problem of decreasing antibiotic effectiveness is going to be the topic this hour. The WHO is talking about a post-antibiotic era unless we can do something to stem the tide of drug-resistant bacteria. This is a global issue. My guest this hour is Dr. Brad Spellberg, Associate Professor in the UCLA Department of Medicine, a member of the Clinical and Translational Science Institute, and he's at the David Geffen School of Medicine in the Division of General Internal Medicine at Harbor UCLA Medical Center. Dr. Spellberg, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you.
Before we get to the substance of the WHO report, let's set the context by talking about what an antibiotic is and perhaps more importantly, what it isn't. What is an antibiotic?
Well, an antibiotic is actually just a poison that is designed specifically to poison bacteria and not to poison us.
Okay. And give me an example of what one of those would be.
Penicillin is the classic, the first true antibiotic.
And now, as I understand it, some antibiotics, and I'm probably going to be badly misusing these terms, some antibiotics occur naturally, others are synthetic, that they've been created in a laboratory. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, you know, technically, the word antibiotic is defined as a substance produced by microbes in nature that inhibit the growth of other microbes. Loosely, we use the term antibiotic, or more generally, antibacterial agent, to describe any small molecule drug that is designed to kill bacteria. So yes, the antibiotic was actually invented by bacteria. Genetic analysis suggests that bacteria invented antibiotics probably on the order of 2 to 2.5 billion years ago with a B. And they've been killing each other with these weapons for 2.5 billion years. We've only discovered them in the last 80 years.
And so people sometimes get antibiotics and vaccines confused, as they do illnesses caused by viruses as opposed to those that are bacterial infections. Before we go any further, we probably better clear that up.
Well, an antibiotic is a chemical. It's a small molecule drug that is designed to kill bacteria. It may be found in nature, or it may be that we've synthesized the chemical. A vaccine is typically a protein or a carbohydrate that we inject into people to stimulate an immune response, and it's then the immune response to the stimulant that protects the host from infection. And a virus, there are viruses that can infect and kill bacteria. They're called bacteriophages. We don't have any of those that we use clinically in the Western world. There are viruses that are used to treat bacterial infections in Eastern Europe. But those are different. Those are not vaccines, and they're not antibiotics.
Okay, so why we've been using antibiotics now for about 80 years. When was the last new antibiotic drug developed and brought to market?
There was an antibiotic developed and brought to market in late 2012 to treat tuberculosis. So there have been a few recently. But if you look at the pace of approvals, it's down about 95% if you compare the period between 1982 to 1986 and the period between 2008 and 2012. So 95% decline over the last 30 years.
And why is that?
There's three reasons that have combined to cause what is termed a market failure of antibiotics on Capitol Hill. The first is the science. The low-hanging fruit has been plucked. There have been about 140 antibiotics developed for human use in the last 80 years. The stuff that's easy to discover has already been discovered, and it's getting increasingly difficult. The science is increasingly difficult to discover the next generation thing. Second is economics. These are poor investment vehicles for research and development dollars. We can talk about the reasons why, but the bottom line is companies make much more money selling a drug you have to take every day for the rest of your life than a drug you're going to take for 7 days and then stop. And then finally, we have had, for complicated statistical reasons, a very hostile regulatory environment at the FDA to getting clinical trials done for new antibiotics for the last 10 to 15 years.
And what's behind that?
Well, I'll try to summarize some very complex issues into a more simple concept. When you bring a new antibiotic to market, you ask the question if the new antibiotic is similarly effective to an antibiotic already on the market. It's not ethical to give patients who are infected placebo. So we can't do superiority trials to see if the new drug is better than placebo. And there are complicated statistics around what are called non-inferiority trials, where you compare drug A to drug B and not to placebo directly. There are solutions to these statistical problems for many types of drugs because there are older placebo-controlled trials. So you know that the drugs are more effective than placebo. But antibiotics hit the market in the United States in 1936. That's 20 years before placebo-controlled trials were done. So there have never been, and there never will be, placebo trials for life-threatening infections. And this has created some statistical concerns at the FDA, which frankly have been massively overblown. We have a molehill of a concern that I would describe radical skeptics have converted into a mountain and created unnecessary barriers to development.
And to what end? I mean, what is it that we're afraid of here?
What they are afraid of is that the FDA could accidentally approve an antibiotic that doesn't actually work because it's similarly effective to a drug already on the market. And if they haven't proven that the drug already on the market is better than placebo, showing something is similarly effective doesn't mean it actually is better than placebo. The problem, what these people have lost sight of is there is no question that antibiotics are better than placebo. I don't have randomized placebo-controlled trials, but all I have to do is look at the death rate of infections immediately before antibiotics became available and immediately afterwards. These are among the largest declines in death you will find from any intervention in all of medicine. These are massively effective therapies. And to ask for placebo data for antibiotics is very similar to asking for placebo data for parachutes for jumping out of an airplane. I don't need a randomized placebo-controlled trial, people. Let's move on. We have to move on for the sake of the public and stop getting hung up in statistical minutia, which really has been the problem at the regulatory level.
And okay, so we've kind of set the stage here. The WHO report talks about a post-antibiotic era looming unless we do something. How did so many bacteria become immune to antibiotics? What led us to this crisis that the World Health Organization is talking about?
Well, you got to remember that, as I said, antibiotics are found in nature, and bacteria have been waging war amongst themselves with these weapons for 2 billion years. So resistance has always been there. It's not new that there's resistance. For a long time, when we bring a new drug out and put it on the market, it starts to get used very heavily. And that causes the rate of spread of resistance to go up. In other words, the more antibiotic you use, you kill off the susceptible bacteria, you leave behind the bacteria that are resistant at small levels, and now all of a sudden they can replicate and spread their resistance. For many years, we would introduce a new antibiotic, resistance would go up, the companies would then introduce the next generation thing, and we would sort of stay one step ahead. The piece of the puzzle that's different is that we're not getting the new things coming out to stay one step ahead. And what we're learning is we're on a constant treadmill. The more we use, the faster resistance spreads, and we no longer have new generation drugs to bail us out. So we're going to have to stretch the lifespan of the drugs that we have much longer than we've had to do over the last 80 years.
And we already have a situation, I believe, in Africa where there is a form of staph infection which is no longer just can't be treated with antibiotics anymore, as I understand.
Well, I don't think staph turns out to not be the big problem in terms of resistance right now. We do have some problems that your audience may have heard of the term MRSA or MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph aureus. This is a strain or a series of strains of staph that are resistant to the first-line therapies we use, which are penicillin derivatives. But we do have therapies for them. The real problem right now with resistance are what we call gram-negative bacteria. These are things like E. coli, other bacteria you find in the intestines, Klebsiella, and bacteria you find in the hospital, like Pseudomonas and Acinetobacter. These are the ones that are becoming resistant to everything, and it's not just in Africa. We have pan-resistant, untreatable bacteria in this country that we are encountering regularly.
Sounds like the hospital is almost the worst place you can go if you want to avoid infection.
Well, you hear this thing all the time, oh, these dirty hospitals. No. Let's take a step back and look at this realistically. Imagine in your mind a building where you take the sickest people in society and cram them all together in one place. You use the highest density of antibiotics because these people are so sick. And you poke new holes in their bodies that they didn't used to have. You put plastic catheters directly into their bloodstream, bypassing their skin. You put tubes directly into their lung, bypassing their throat and mouth. You put tubes directly into their bladder, bypassing the normal anatomy that protects from getting bacteria into the bladder. All these interventions that we do as a part of modern intensive care medicine actually allow direct access inside the body to bacteria that couldn't otherwise get there. So when you concentrate the sickest people in society into one place, use the highest density of antibiotics in that place, and create anatomical defects in people so that bacteria can get inside patients, that's why hospitals are dangerous places to be, and you should only be in the hospital if you really have to be.
What about, when antibiotics were first being developed, they were primarily used in human beings. What we have seen, however, in recent decades is that antibiotics are being used in the animals that end up as dinner on our plates every night. What effect has the use of antibiotics in livestock had on this resistance?
Yeah, I think this is a great question. It's a key question, and it's a question that your audience really needs to start to make its voice heard about. So what is little known is that 80% of the antibiotics used in this country, 80%, go into animals, not people. That amounts to about 34 million pounds of antibiotics per year. 34 million pounds per year are put into animals in this country. The vast majority of that is not to treat sick animals. It is to, quote-unquote, growth-promote livestock. In the 1950s, it was discovered that if you feed subtherapeutic levels of antibiotics to animals, they will grow bigger faster. And we are just now starting to learn the science behind why this is. But the bottom line is that it is a huge economic boon to the agribusiness lobby. And so it has become, despite multiple efforts at the FDA and in legislation to stop this disgraceful practice, it has not been successfully stopped. In Europe, they have stopped it, and they have had no harm to their herds or animals, and they've actually seen Denmark was the first country to stop growth promotional antibiotics. They actually had an increase in hog production after they did it. So there's no evidence that there's any harm to the animals by stopping this. There is substantial evidence that feeding antibiotics to animals directly allows transmission of antibiotic-resistant bacteria from the herds to people via a variety of routes. So it certainly does contribute to the resistance we see in patients, and we simply need to stop doing it.
We had a comment from Brad on Facebook that was exactly what you were just talking about here, Doctor. Scientists agree that giving antibiotics to healthy poultry, livestock, and fish on farms is irresponsible and risks developing antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria. We should ban this practice in Wisconsin. These antibiotics are even found in our meat and in trace amounts and in our waterways. So are we, when we drink water and when we eat this meat that's been treated with antibiotics, are we taking those in as well? And is this part of the picture here about creating these resistant bacteria?
Yes, I think so. So there are three sort of routes that I think are fairly well established for how the use of agricultural antibiotics can transmit resistance to people. It is not so much that you transmit the antibiotic. It is that when you feed the antibiotic to the animal, you select for resistance in the gut of the animal. So you have created antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria in the livestock. When the animal is butchered, there are small amounts of bacteria that get in the meat. And if you ingest that meat, it ends up in your gut. I've had people say, I don't need to worry about that, I'm a vegetarian. Well, I hate to break this to you, but guess where they get the fertilizer from to grow the crop? It's from the same animals that were fed subtherapeutic levels of antibiotics. So you will get bacteria on the vegetables that you ingest. And finally, there is evidence that antibiotics can breed bacteria in environments, including in well water or water reservoirs, that if you drink the water and there's bacteria in it, it will end up in your gut. That's probably the primary way. Those three ways are probably the primary ways that bacteria end up going from livestock into people.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the Kathleen Dunn program today. That's a different number than the one you're used to using. 800-642-1234. Email is still talk@WPR.org, or you can find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, as Brad did, and leave your comment or question for Dr. Spellberg there. So please get in touch. This is a really important topic, which is why we're talking about it, and we have lots to talk about still to come. We will be talking about the use of antibiotics, how they should be used. And one of the things I'd like to get to, Doctor, we're going to be taking a short break here, but before the end of the show, I'd like you to describe for us what the post-antibiotic era that the WHO is talking about looks like, because most of us aren't old enough to remember what it was like before we had antibiotic treatments for things like pneumonia, for example, bacterial pneumonia, or what would happen if a person cut themselves badly. That was a completely different world, and I'd like you to maybe give us that, give us a description of what it would be like if we did not have working antibiotics. It would be a completely different world. This is what the WHO is warning us about. My guest, Dr. Brad Spellberg, you're welcome to join us in our conversation. Dr. Spellberg is a professor of medicine at Harbor UCLA Medical Center, where he joins us from this afternoon. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a note referring to a program previously heard on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Harvey Kay, author of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great, will be presenting his latest book at a signing tonight at 7 o'clock in Turner Hall Ballroom in Milwaukee, located at 1034 North 4th Street in Milwaukee. I trust this information is up on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We're talking about a warning from the World Health Organization that the decreasing effectiveness of antibiotics and other antimicrobial agents is becoming a global problem. My guest this hour is Dr. Brad Spellberg, who is a professor of medicine at the Harbor UCLA Medical Center. For those of us who are going to be patients, maybe our patients now, we're seeing our doctor, we may have an infection. What advice would you give people who need antibiotic treatment? Obviously, that's for the doctor to determine after having done the proper lab work. But what should we know about when we go in to see our physician about antibiotic treatment?
Well, I would say the first thing is that you got to remember that that antibiotics don't work against viruses. They only work against bacteria. And if we give them for a virus, not only will you not get benefit from it, but you'll get side effects from the antibiotic, and you will help select out for resistance in the bacteria that are on or in your body. So the first thing we want to do is to make sure that both doctors and patients understand that antibiotics don't work for viruses, and don't ask for, if the doctor says, I think this is a virus, don't expect or ask for an antibiotic. I would go so far to say, you know, if you're an outpatient, if you're not terribly sick, and you come in and you say, you know, here's my problem, and the doctor says, here's your prescription, and it's an antibiotic, it's perfectly reasonable to say, do I really need this? Could this just be a virus? And flip the conversation around the other way. And if the doctor says, no, I think this is a bacteria, then, of course, you would take the prescription. But we want to move away from the reflexive response of, I have a sore throat, I have a runny nose, you know, I have flu-like symptoms, give me antibiotics. That is absolutely contributing to the spread of resistance.
Well, most of us, if we get sick, well, give me a pill, make this go away. I mean, that's, you know, that's how we feel. We're sick. All we know is we want to get better, and we probably don't understand because we didn't go to medical school. We don't understand what causes various types of illness. We just know that doctors have all these pills and they can give me one and make whatever this is better. That's not a realistic expectation, but that seems to be where we are in terms of how we interact with medicine.
Yeah, well, the sad reality is that with current diagnostics, doctors often don't know for sure what you have. They can say there's a 95% chance this is a virus and a 5% chance it's a bacteria. And in many circumstances, then the doctor will give you a prescription just because they don't want to be wrong. They don't want to hurt you by being wrong. And what we need to do is to move towards situations where if you have a mild outpatient infection that is likely viral, we do not reflexively jump to giving the antibiotic. And that's a very difficult thing for both patient and provider. So there are ways that we need to move towards to deal with this. For example, we need better diagnostics. You know, there is, for example, a rapid strep throat test. And in an hour or less, in the doctor's office, the test can tell you this is strep throat caused by bacteria or not. Those kinds of tests are going to increasingly enter the marketplace in the coming 5 years, and that will really help us to stop giving antibiotics to people who don't need them.
800-642-1234. We talked a little, is the number to call to join the program. We talked a little bit earlier about what happens in the hospital. So if someone has to go to the hospital, is there some way to protect themselves from, say, a MRSA infection?
Well, you know, as it turns out, that the evidence is that when you get infected by a MRSA in the hospital, it's usually by a strain that you brought into the hospital yourself. So transmission from other people to you of MRSA is actually not the most common way that it happens in the hospital. What I would say is this. Number one, only go into the hospital if you really need to be there, right? Seriously, you'd be surprised how often I hear people tell me, "Doc, it feels like you're rushing me out of the hospital." Well, guess what? I am, because you should only be there if I can only provide the therapy you need in the hospital. If I can find a way to provide that therapy outside the hospital, you should not be in the hospital. Number two, hand washing remains the cornerstone of infection prevention. The patient should feel empowered. If you are in the hospital and you see a nurse, a doctor, a blood drawer, phlebotomist, anybody come to the bedside, start touching you or anything in contact with you without washing their hands, you should say, "Excuse me, would you mind washing your hands?" None of us are perfect. All of us make mistakes. This is about the patient. The patient should be empowered to intervene. And then the third thing, as I alluded to, is work with your medical team to get out of the hospital by whatever means necessary as early as you can.
Well, generally, the food alone would drive me out of the hospital. But wait, now we have another incentive. Let's take some phone calls. We have some people who want to join us, and they have some great questions to ask as well. Room for you if you want to join right now at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We'll start in La Crosse. And Cheryl is with us. Cheryl, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I joined your program late, so you may have touched on this early, but I heard in the last 10 minutes a discussion about antibiotic use in animals. And your guest spoke about the European, specifically Denmark, where they reduced subtherapeutic use or eliminated the use of antibiotics subtherapeutically. I remember reading that study, and it showed that they actually use as much, if not more, of antibiotics just treating sick animals after that happened. If there's been more recent studies, I guess I haven't seen them. Did your guest see that study?
Yeah, so this was an extremely enlightening exchange that occurred at an Institute of Medicine meeting some years ago. What you're referring to is that if you look at the raw tonnage of antibiotics that were used in Denmark in the pre- and post-period, the raw tonnage did go up by about 50%, if I recall, after the ban. But that was in the context of a 1,200% increase in hog production, 1,200% increase in hog production. So the amount of antibiotics used per animal was much lower. And so what you have to think about is, how much antibiotics would they have used had they not banned growth promotional antibiotics and still had a 1,200% increase in hog production? It would have gone up 1,200%, not, you know, 50%. So what you have to look at is, what would the impact have been had they not done the ban? And part of the reason why people in this country say we can't do that ban is because it'll hurt the animals and farmers will not be able to grow as many animals. The Denmark experience proves that that's not true. They massively increased their animal production while giving much fewer amounts of antibiotics per animal.
Cheryl, thanks for that call and getting us to clear up that point. Let's go next to Jerry in Cumberland. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
Yes. I have a question.
Hello, Jerry? Oh, you're cutting in and out. Must be on a cell. Jerry's question had to do with whether or not it's possible for us to alter antibiotics, which were successful before, but now are finding resistance. They're not as effective as they were. Can we take something we already have and fix it?
Yes, we can. And in fact, that's been done multiple times over the last 50 years. One of the lead antibiotics that's currently in development actually is that. And so what happens is, as one example, is you'll take a penicillin derivative. The resistance to penicillin is often mediated by enzymes that destroy the penicillin antibiotic called beta-lactamases. And there are inhibitors, beta-lactamase inhibitors. So you give a combination drug now. You give the penicillin and the protective agent that blocks the enzyme that would destroy the penicillin. That has been done repeatedly. The problem, I think, is that we have pushed the chemicals that we have about as far as we're going to be able to push them. We are now sort of really digging to the bottom of the barrel with what we have. We need some innovative new starting structures. And what we know for sure from the past 50 years, if we get one or two new starting structures, we can spend the next 50 years doing the kind of modifications that you're talking about to extend the lifespan of effective therapy.
800-642-1234 is the toll-free number to use to join the Kathleen Dunn program. John Munson in for Kathleen this week. If you get a busy signal, send us an email, talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org, or post to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and we'll take your comment and share it with our listening audience. My guest is Dr. Brad Spellberg, and we're talking about a WHO report issuing a pretty stark warning about what would happen if we did not deal with what they refer to as the global problem of decreasing antibiotic effectiveness. That's what we're talking about this hour on the Kathleen Dunn Program. The WHO does lay things up pretty starkly. I mean, they're basically saying, hey, look, we're standing at the edge of the cliff here, and we don't have 10 or 15 years to fix this problem. The problem is here, and if we don't take some immediate action on this globally, not just the United States, not just Europe, not just Asia, the whole entire world is at some risk. Let's try to maybe draw a more detailed picture of what the risk is that we're talking about here, because as I said earlier, most of us in the listening audience probably aren't old enough to remember what the world was like before we had antibiotics to treat, infections. And what would that be like if we didn't have antibiotics that worked?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right on all counts. So I'll give you a couple of examples. The average lifespan of people in the United States went up on the order of 20 to 25 years after the introduction of effective antibiotic therapy. So the first thing that you would be talking about is a marked decrease in average lifespan. You mentioned the chance of dying from infections that are very common, like pneumonia and skin infections. Skin infections, simple skin infections in the pre-antibiotic era had a 11% death rate. That's based on an analysis of 29,000 patients, so it's a very robust number. Now, let me put that in perspective. 11% chance of dying of a skin infection. In 1988, there was a very large clinical trial, which was the first to show that aspirin and clot-busting drugs reduced the risk of death from heart attacks. The death rate in the placebo arm of that study from heart attacks was 12%. Which means that in the pre-antibiotic era, the chance of dying of a skin infection was the same as the chance of dying of a heart attack. The decline in death from antibiotics, remember I said you don't need randomized placebo-controlled trials? The decline in death for skin infections when antibiotics came along was about 95 to 98%. So now we see death rates less than 0.5%, less than, say, 5 in 1,000. We used to have 11% death rates. It's a massive decline in death. The decline in death from heart attacks for aspirin or clot-busting drugs was 3%. So antibiotics are much more life-saving for skin infections than standard therapies are for heart attacks. Pneumonia. In the pre-antibiotic era, 1 in 3 patients died. If you were over the age of 60, you had a 60% chance of dying of your pneumonia. This is why they used to call pneumonia the old man's best friend. With antibiotics, the death rate of pneumonia is well under 10%. Probably on the order of 2 to 5% for younger people. It's still not more than 10% for older people. So So these are massively effective therapies at reducing your chance of dying from bacterial infections.
Wow, that's, I mean, and when you take that and you put it in the context of the entire population of the world, those numbers become even more staggering. Let's take a phone call from Mary Lee in Madison next. Mary Lee, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. My question is, my daughter, who's 18, has had some severe acne trouble, and she's been on antibiotics for that, and I'm just, you know, for several months, and it doesn't seem to be making a huge amount of difference. So I'm just wondering about, you know, the impact of that and the if it's worthwhile for her to be on them and for how long, and so what you think of that.
Well, it's a really great question, and it has a lot of facets to it. So I'd say the starting point is anytime you're considering as a physician what treatments to use, you have to weigh pros and cons, risks and benefits. There is no free lunch. Every treatment we use for a disease has a cost. And what we try to do is use the treatments that have the biggest return for the least cost. Acne is often caused by or triggered by bacteria like Propionibacterium getting into the wrong place, but really it's a disease of an inflammatory response to the bacteria. So sometimes antibiotics work. Sometimes there are other options that might be better than antibiotics. What I can tell you for sure is that when you take an antibiotic, you are absolutely killing off susceptible bacteria in and on your body. We need to remember the human body has about 10 trillion cells in it of our own. It carries about 100 trillion bacteria in and on us. So there are 10 times more bacteria in and on us than there are our own cells in our body. The effect of taking an antibiotic, even when you need it, is going to be to select for resistance. So what I would suggest is, in a situation where you're dealing with a non-life-threatening infection, where a lot of the process is caused by inflammation, not so much by a virulent bacteria, perhaps using a non-antibiotic-based treatment might be a way to go, and it's something I would certainly be discussing with the dermatologist or primary care physician who's managing your daughter's acne.
Mm-hmm. Mary Lee, thanks for the call, and good luck with getting your daughter's acne properly treated. Let's take another call. We'll go to Bill in Wakefield next. Bill, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my mother suffered a series of infections, and we just basically decided to kind of grab the bull by the horns. It's like you feel like David and Goliath is the pharma companies, and you're David, and it's like you have to do your own research because it almost put her in the ground. And it's like they just keep dishing stuff to you, and some of the stuff would react with other stuff, and it's just like the best advice I guess a person could give is do your own homework before you go into the office.
Bill, thanks for the call. Dr. Spellberg, it is crucially important that we as patients make ourselves as informed as we can be. One problem might be, where do we get really reliable information? Because there's a lot of stuff out there that isn't necessarily kosher.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very fair point. I would also add, however, medicine is not easy. Okay, we are. I had a mentor a long time ago who used to tell me, MD stands for make decisions. This is not house MD. This is not in an hour you get an answer. Most of the time your physician is making a decision about how to treat you, they don't actually know definitively what the right thing to do is. They are weighing risks and benefits. So all of us are in this position of trying to do the best we can with the limited information we have. I would say that I would not paint pharma as the bad guy here. If we did not have pharma developing antibiotics, we wouldn't have antibiotics to save lives. That's not to say that pharma hasn't made a lot of mistakes. Okay. It's not to say that pharma doesn't need to be very carefully regulated, because they do. They are, you know, they're run by business people who need to be regulated. But we do need participation of industry as well as government. We need to move more towards a public-private partnership model to get the drugs we need developed for our patients. As far as where to get information, the best place to start, honestly, is with your treating physician. And they can refer you, because there are hundreds and hundreds of different ways that people who are infected present. They can refer you to areas to look for more information.
800-642-1234. Lines will be coming available shortly. Let's take one more call before we go to our next break. We'll go to Nick in Green Bay next. Nick, thanks for being here today.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You know what's really scary is if you talk about infections and stuff, when I had my first daughter, our insurance was willing to pay for a five-day stay after the birth, and those nurses pretty much begged us to stay in the hospital up until midnight of the night that we had to leave. It's really scary because with you talking about all the germs and stuff and all the resistant, you know, bugs out there, you know, what are the chances that she could have got an infection, especially having a C-section?
Nick, can I ask you this before we have Dr. Spielberg respond? Why did they want you? Did they give a reason for wanting you to stay longer?
No, they just said, you know, why not use it? They're like, you can stay a week, so you should just stay a week. And, you know, it's kind of scary with all the drugs or the, you know, the bugs flowing around the hospital.
Dr. Spielberg?
Yeah, that's 1950s medicine. And I have to say that it is an unfortunate reality that the way our healthcare system works is sometimes people or systems get paid not necessarily to do the right thing. So this is about patient empowerment. You want to get out of that hospital as fast as you can. You should be trying to explore every opportunity. If they say, well, you need to get more antibiotic therapy. Well, can I get it at home? Can you switch me to an oral regimen? The only reason a patient should be in the hospital is, can I deliver care to them in the hospital that I cannot deliver to them outside the hospital? If the answer to that question is not yes, they should not be in the hospital. And patients should be empowered to say, give me an alternative. I want to go home as soon as I can.
Nick, thanks so much for that call. We have other callers, and we'll take them in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with more with Dr. Spielberg and with you if you choose to join us. Lines available now at 800-642-1234. Dr. Brad Spielberg is professor of medicine at Harbor UCLA Medical Center. We're talking about recent warnings. A WHO World Health Organization report suggests we are approaching the post-antibiotic era, a pretty scary thing when you think about it. Most of us don't think about it, and that's one of the reasons we're doing this program today. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about a report from the World Health Organization, some 250-plus pages, about the global problem of the decreasing effectiveness of antibiotics. The WHO is talking about a post-antibiotic era unless we can do something to stem the tide of drug-resistant bacteria. Helping us to sort out this problem, and maybe we should spend the rest of the hour talking about what can be done, is Dr. Brad Spielberg, professor of medicine at Harbor UCLA Medical Center. And Dr. Spielberg, we have a caller who has a question about the use of antibiotics in livestock. Mark in southern Wisconsin. Let's go to you next. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, guys, thanks for taking my call. Basically, here's my situation. I'm a farmer, and I'm not – what he's saying is it, everything is right and it's scary, right? And basically, what can be done on my level, you know, to start this change or movement? Because it, and you know, in my defense and in my boss's defense, it's basically we just do what our reps and our consultants and our, you know, our vets tell us to do. And it's the way they see it. You know, the old school farmer type is if Joe Schmo down the road's doing it, I've got to do it. And it's just, I don't know. Excuse me, I got it.
Yeah, Mark, I got to say, I feel for you. And, you know, I have heard this multiple times from farmers, all, you know, mostly in California that I've spoken with. This is sort of like steroids in baseball. If you allow one person to do it, then everybody's going to do it. It's an issue of competition. I think this is an absolutely legitimate point. There's only two ways that I can think of or am aware of that this problem can be dealt with. One is at the legislative level, is that the playing field has to be even for everyone. You have to say this is bad for the public, everyone stop doing it. And then we don't put people like yourself into this position of trying to make a decision about whether you should make a financially disadvantageous decision for yourself and your farm compared to all your competitors. The second way to do it is to enter the organic meat market or the organic vegetable market. The organic market is relatively small but probably growing. And it may be an avenue for farmers that are very uncomfortable competing where they have to give antibiotics, where they could try to enter a different market and feel better about things. But I really do think at the end of the day, we need legislation. And that means we're going to need the public to tell their representatives, look, you got to fix this.
Mm-hmm. Mark, thanks so much for the call and good luck. So there's a legislative component to this. We need to tell our legislators, hey, look, we're getting killed here by these drug-resistant bacteria. We need to do something. What else can we do? I mean, there's certainly an enormous lobby that's telling Congress, ignore all those people. We need to keep giving these antibiotics because corporate profits would be affected if we don't.
Yeah, I think that's true. It is an issue of we're going to need grassroots advocacy to get legislation passed. Legislation is not viable right now for the reasons that you're talking about. So the two things that the public can do is, one is tell the representatives, we actually care about this and we want you to stop it. We want you to get legislation through that stops this practice so that everyone has an even playing field. And the second thing is to consider whether you want to enter the organic meat market, whether as a producer or as a consumer. Also, we've talked about other things that your listeners can do. You know, hand washing is the cornerstone of infection prevention. Regular, routine hand washing and maintaining good hygiene at home, living a healthy lifestyle to try to reduce the risk that you're going to end up in the hospital, and getting out of the hospital when you're in it as soon as you can. And finally, trying not to take antibiotics unless you need them, flipping the conversation around. Doc, do I really need this? Because I don't want to take it if I don't really need it.
Mm. Let's take another phone call. Chris is in Stevens Point. We'll go there next. Chris, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was curious about how much of the overall amount of antibiotic use in livestock is subtherapeutic. So if we were to ban it in the United States, how would that affect the numbers in terms of antibiotics used in the United States?
Well, you know, it actually turns out to be hard to get exact numbers on this. From my understanding, talking to people, so I have not seen hard numbers, but talking to people who live in this space, probably on the order of 70 to 80% of the antibiotic use in livestock is for growth promotional purposes.
Hmm. That's a pretty big number.
Yep.
Here's a question that Ann posted on Facebook. Do vaccinations against common illnesses significantly reduce the need for antibiotics? For viral diseases like flu, isn't it secondary bacterial infections that lead to hospitalizations? So would vaccinations help to prevent this?
Oh, absolutely. Vaccinations absolutely can help to prevent this. Now, we have some good vaccines out there, for example, for pneumonia. And if you take the vaccine and have a lower chance of getting pneumonia, then you'll have a lower chance of needing antibiotics, and our antibiotic use will go down. And so, yes, that absolutely plays a role. What we really would need to do is to expand the types of bacteria that we go after with vaccines. And there is a lot of interest in this at the scientific level, at the National Institutes of Health, for example. And I will disclose that my laboratory focuses on looking at vaccines and immune-enhancing strategies to deal with infections. So, yes, I think that is an untapped, unmet scientific need that we need to continue to expand into.
Let's see. We've got time. Let's go next to Stanley in Augusta. Stanley, thanks for being here today.
Yeah. Hello, John and Jeff. You've been kind of talking a lot about antibiotic use in agriculture and the need for change. And I agree with the need for change. We are working on currently new FDA rules about the use of subtherapeutic antibiotics that is being worked on, processed, and nearly universally accepted by most of the drug manufacturers, processors for the subtherapeutic use. And also would like to bring up that when these topics are talked about, we throw out that 80% number of all antibiotics are used in animals. And I would really like to get out there that of that 80%, 40% of them are a class of drugs that are never used in human medicine. So so that we are talking about a much smaller amount of drugs, and it is not an insurmountable problem. The only reason to mention that 80% number is if your goal is to scare people rather than inform people.
Well, I'm going to tackle the second comment first. What you say is technically true, but it misses the point, which is that we know for a fact, and it's been shown over and over, you don't have to use the same antibiotic to select for resistance to it. Antibiotic resistance travels in genetically linked groups, in mobile, transmissible elements. And where one resistance element is found, typically multiple resistance elements are found. So I can use an antibacterial that is not ever used in humans, and I can select for resistance to antibiotics that are used in humans. And there's no question that that is true. It's been shown over and over and over again. So do not write off the fraction of antibiotics used in animals that are not also exactly the same as those used in people, because those antibiotics will select for resistance to antibiotics that are used in people. The first point is true. The FDA has implemented voluntary stipulations to companies to withdraw growth promotional antibiotics. And I think all of us were happy to see that. But the history is that that goes back 40 years. The FDA first began trying to regulate this in the 70s. And every time something has come forward where it looked like it might work, the agribusiness lobby has struck back and Congress has defanged the FDA. So ultimately, while I would hope that we would see some benefit from the voluntary regulations, I think most people who have been in this space a long time feel that we're going to need mandatory legislation to really solve the problem.
Stanley, thanks for the call. Cecilia in Appleton, let's go to you quickly next as we're getting close to the end of the program. Cecilia, go ahead.
Hi, I was just wondering if you had any recommendations on taking like a nutrition sort of way of fixing what's going on with the inflammation and the bacteria, if you change your diet or if you would eat certain foods that would help you instead of going, you know, to the antibiotic solution. Do you have anything that we can do for nutrition-wise that can help us?
Well, what I would say, generally speaking, and there are a few exceptions, there are some diseases, for example, like ciliary disease, where you need to eat a specific type of diet. But for most people, the fact is you just need to eat a healthy diet. And there isn't going to be any magical solution to the type of foods you eat that's going to, quote-unquote, boost your immunity. There's no evidence that you can enhance the strength of your immune system by eating certain foods. What is true is that if you eat an unhealthy diet, you can get diseases that are bad for you, heart disease, diabetes, for example, some of which can affect your immune system, like diabetes. So I would say, in general, eating a healthy diet is key. Now, in the future, we are likely to have what are called probiotic solutions to some diseases. So, for example, there is a disease called C. diff colitis, which is a side effect of antibiotics. You take an antibiotic, it kills off the healthy bacteria in your gut. A nasty bacteria called C. diff sets up shop in your gut, causes an infection that you can die from. We are starting to learn that we can repopulate the normal bacteria in your gut as a treatment or prevention for C. diff. So there are likely to be some infections in the future that we are able to use, quote-unquote, dietary or probiotic therapy for. We're not quite there yet, but we're getting there.
So the WHO report, was it, in your view, does it strike the right tone? Or how close to the edge of this cliff are we? Should we be sounding an even bigger alarm than the WHO did? Or where were they, do you think, on this?
Well, you know, I think that the WHO is the latest to fire off a salvo. There have been multiple organizations over the last several years that have sounded the alarm, CDC, World Economic Forum, the NIH, the IDSA. So certainly I think it's a welcome addition to that. I don't think that they overstated the problem. I don't think they necessarily understated the problem. I think what they put out was a fairly accurate representation of where we're at and where we're headed if we don't change directions.
All right. Well, that's where we'll leave it. Dr. Spellberg, thank you so much for spending this time with us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Spellberg is a professor of medicine at Harbor UCLA Medical Center. This program was produced by K.P. Whaley. We had on-air production help today from Michelle Good and Marika Suval. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn, reminding you that you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.